The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast, episode 694. It's the 26th of January, 2016. On the podcast today, I have Tim McCarthy, chairman of IMMU Pharma, that's IMM ticker, gives us an update on their phase 3 clinical trials for its lead drug, Lupizor. Also on the podcast, Rob Proctor, CEO of Audioboom, ticker there is Boom, talks about their acquisition of Sonar and their convertible loan note issued to cornerstone investor Nick Candy. Also, Doc Holliday, small cap commentator, talks about URU Metals, ECR Minerals and Hydrodeck. Plus, Alan Green, CEO of Brand Communications, talks about Angus Energy, Feedback, Advanced Oncotherapy and Swallowfield. Plus, have the top five most followed companies on the Vox Markets website in the last 24 hours, and platform and app, by the way. And also, the most liked RNSs on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, too.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Tim McCarthy, chairman of IMMU Pharma. That's IMM ticker. Tim, thanks for coming back on.
No problem, Justin. It's good to speak to you again.
Yes, the last time we talked was back in August, I think. So you've had lots of news out, including recently. Yesterday's news was very good. Had a good positive reaction on the share price. We'll go through that in a bit. But what I'd like to do at the start here is, for people not aware of IMMU Pharma or new listeners of the podcast, can you tell us exactly what IMMU Pharma does as a business, please, Tim?
Of course. IMMU Pharma is an AIM-listed company. We've been on the AIM market for just over 10 years now. And we conduct research and development into new drug treatments. We have a number of treatments in what we call the clinical trial process, which is where you test these drugs for both efficacy and safety. And the drug, our lead drug, as we call it, which is the most advanced in its development, is a drug called Lupizor, which is for the treatment of an autoimmune disease, quite a difficult disease for patients, called lupus. And the reason we're talking today, Justin, is because we put an update out this morning on the development of that drug. Some very good news about the recruitment of patients into the trial and how it's progressing, which I'm sure we'll come on to in a moment. But essentially, for any new listeners to the podcast, we describe ourselves as a pharmaceutical development company, in colloquial terms, a biotech company.
Mm-hmm. Okay, all right, yes. Yeah. So you've done an update on the sort of pivotal phase 3 study there. And let's go through some questions here. So first of all, 200 patients, you know, you complete the recruitment of that. How important was that? And, you know, how important is it to be on track? Because I understand with costs and stuff, right, I suppose it's very important, is it?
Yes, all of those things are important. And again, just to put it in context for any of your listeners that are not familiar, what we have is this drug called Lupizor, which is in what's called the phase 3 of the clinical trial process. Now, that is the last stage before we can potentially go to the regulators, get approval and get it marketed. That means it's a late stage development. That means it's nearer potentially to the market, and by implication, it's of more value because a lot of the risk of the development has been taken out. So what we have to be very aware of is that these trials are very expensive. They last a long time over the piece of phase 1, phase 2, phase 3. And so the fact that we have this late stage drug Lupizor in phase 3, and what we announced today was confirmation of the 200 patients in the study and that it was on track, is very important. Not only because, as you say, if we were delayed at all, that potentially could increase costs, but perhaps more importantly, once you have the 200 patients in the study, and that's how many we need for this particular study, then you have certainty of delivery. And what I mean by that is, you cannot report a clinical study, you can't complete a clinical study unless you've got all of the patients in that you require, in our case 200. So it's a really important milestone for us to reach, and it's important that we keep it on track, both for the patients that are in the study, for our own internal control purposes, but also from an investment perspective. Investors can now look in at the company and look at this study and know exactly what the timelines are.
Yeah, and looking at the breakdown of patients, there, you have 7 countries, 28 sites, and over 70 patients have been dosed in the US. Is this significant?
Yeah, the spread of patients across all the sites and all the countries is important. And we have patients, as you rightly say, 70 patients being dosed in a number of centres in the US, 11 centres, in fact. And then we also have centres across mainland Europe, and we also have one in Mauritius, where there happens to be a high incidence of lupus in the population, which is why we chose to go there. The importance of the US is important from a point of view that the main regulator that's overseeing this trial is the American FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, who is the gatekeeper, if you like, for the drug industry in the United States. The United States being the biggest pharmaceutical market in the world from a commercial point of view. So it's important that we had a good proportion of the patients in this study in the US. But having said that, it's just as important that we get a good spread, as I say, across Europe and in Mauritius, because that gives a lot more weight to the study and the results, because you've got a good spread of patients from different backgrounds, different cultures, and it ensures the integrity, if you like, of the study and the study results. So it wouldn't have been as significant if it was all concentrated in one area, say all in the States. The fact we've got it spread across many, many different countries is a big advantage for us.
Yeah, and of the trials, when you go through the trials, it's obviously the points that are highlighted are, you know, safety, efficacy and effectiveness. So can you go through the bit about the safety part? Because I know you did comment on this in the RNS. Take us through that, please, yeah, if you could, Tim.
Well, with any drug, it's usually a balance of benefit versus risk. And what I mean by that is most drugs will provide benefit to a patient, otherwise they wouldn't have been approved in the first place. But at the end of the day, you're usually putting a chemical into a patient's body. That's what a drug is. And it normally gives side effects. And this risk benefit balance is very much about, is the patient able or willing to put up with the side effect profile that a drug gives in order to get the bigger benefit that they receive in treating their particular disease or condition. And that is the equation that companies that are developing drugs and regulators like the FDA go through to make sure that balance is correct. Lupusor, we're in the very unusual situation that in all our clinical studies to date, and certainly in all of the literature and all of our research from the start, is demonstrating that Lupusor is very effective, or very efficacious, as we call it in the industry. So giving patients a lot of benefit and relief from their symptoms, but with no side effect profile whatsoever. So what we call a benign safety profile. And what we reported today, that certainly to date in the study, and we've certainly had two patients have completed their whole 12 months of drug treatment, and a lot more have been through the major proportion of the study time. To date, we've seen absolutely no adverse events, serious adverse events from the study. And that sends a really big signal out. What it's essentially saying is that so far, the drug is presenting the profile which we are looking for. Now, we obviously don't know until we get to the end of the study and we understand the results, what we call we unblind it, so that we understand what the true results are. We won't know what the efficacy of it is. Obviously, we're very confident and we're very hopeful that it will demonstrate good efficacy as it has to date. But certainly the fact we've had no serious adverse events to date, which is the technical term for side effects, is very encouraging. And that's why we wanted to put it into the release.
Yeah, and I suppose before we go any further, we should sort of point out, which we haven't done yet, that's the potential, the commercial potential, because, like you say, it's going well so far, phase three trials. But once it becomes commercial, if it becomes commercial, what is the potential here?
Well, the potential commercially is what we call a blockbuster status. The definition of a blockbuster status in the drug industry is any drug that sells a minimum of $1 billion, that's billion with a B, dollars worth of sales each year. There are many examples out there in the industry of drugs that are selling 3, 4, 5 billion. In fact, the highest selling drug is a drug for rheumatoid arthritis, which is selling something in the region of 13 billion. So these numbers are achievable, but you have to have the right profile of the drug in terms of, as I was saying before, this balance of benefit versus risk. But also you need to have the patient demand and the patient population. And at the moment, we have an incidence across the world of approximately 5 million patients that are not being treated well, and they're suffering from their disease. If you narrow that down to what I call the more accessible markets, the pharmaceutical markets, that would include the US, mainland Europe, Japan. These are the more accessible markets. And within those markets, you've got 1.5 million patients. So being quite conservative, if we were to, we or our partner, whoever ends up marketing this drug, sells this drug out at $20,000 a year. And I know that sounds a lot, but it's not for the type of treatment that's being delivered. Then you only need 50,000 patients per year at 20,000 per treatment per year to get to your $1 billion. So with 1.5 million accessible patients in the developed world, or what I say the developed pharmaceutical markets, the fact that we are saying we believe this drug will be a multi-billion dollar drug, that's the support that we have. And there is really no other treatment on the market which is truly effective with no side effect profile. And so it's what we call an unmet medical need.
Yeah, and I just like the term blockbuster drug. It sounds good, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It's very evocative. But I think once you explain what it means, then people do understand it. And I'm very careful not to just throw numbers around, because it's very easy, especially in the pharmaceutical industry, when you do talk about large numbers of patients and or sales of a drug, to just put a statement out there to say, we believe this drug is going to be a blockbuster, i.e. a multi-billion dollar. I like to support that with evidence of the numbers, as I've just ran through them with you then, but also just to point out that in terms of competition and what else there is out there, there is completely open market for Lupusor to be launched into.
Okay, all right. So you are, like I said, going through this phase 3 now, clinical trials. So where are you and what's next, Tim?
Okay, so the study, each patient is receiving the drug for 12 months. Mm-hmm. So the last patient has just recently gone in. So that last patient will complete their treatment towards the end of this year, just early to 2018. And then again, what we put in the result, sorry, in the release this morning, was that we should expect top line results sometime in the first quarter. Because it takes time once the last patient's completed treatment to assimilate all the data, make sure it's all together, and then we what we call unblind it, because you'll probably be familiar with the fact that all of these trials are what we call double blind placebo controlled, and the double blind means that neither the physician who is administering the drug or the patient who is receiving it know whether they are on active drug or placebo. And you have to have a placebo control in these drugs, sorry, in these trials, so that you can see that there is a real effect or not of the real drug versus a placebo. And so during the study, everyone just has a code number or a code name, so nobody knows who is receiving what. So once we've got all the patients completed and we have all the data collected from all the different sites and it's all in one database, then we can unblind it. And at that point, we will know what the results of the study are. So the guidance we're giving is that should be expected in the first quarter of 2018. That is obviously a major milestone for us. In the meantime, between now and then, we will give regular updates on this study, as we have done this morning. And not forgetting, I know this interview is very much about the release this morning in Lupusor, but we do have other drug development programs which are slightly earlier in clinical development, and we are putting a lot more attention to those now. So I would anticipate there will be some updates on those drug developments this year as well.
Marvellous. Well, listen, if someone's listening right now, Tim, and they don't follow Emu Farmer on Vox Markets, can you give us three reasons why someone should hit that follow button, please?
Yes, I think I would try and describe Emu Farmer, and especially the late-stage drug it's got, Lupusor, as being quite unique. So if people are trying to follow different companies on AIM or just generally, why should they follow Emu Farma? I think we're in a very unique position having Lupusor in such a late-stage trial, it's the last stage of its development. And what I didn't say during this interview was that we own 100% of it. So all the upside is ours. And I think that's really important to get that point across, because that's not always the case in our industry. As I just mentioned to you, we now have a definitive timetable on when we get these results. And that's really important, because obviously people can look forward. It's a big milestone. We're talking just over 12 months out. But the fact that we have now completed recruitment means we know what that timetable is. We will finish the study and we will get the results. And that is a major step forward. The third point is back to value, and we talked about the commercial potential. There are several brokers' notes in circulation, which are very supportive of Emu Farmer and Lupusor as a drug in particular. You know, with buy recommendations and current share price targets anywhere up to £1.71. We're currently trading around 50 pence. So from my perspective, I think there is a lot of upside if anybody's interested in looking at Emu Farmer as an investment. And what we've just discussed today, I think, is a major asset. And certainly so far to date, and what we've put in our release today, everything is going really well. We're really pleased with the development.
Yeah.
Absolutely delighted.
Excellent, Tim. And as, you know, as far as you're concerned, you are sort of in the business end of this development of this drug. So it's a very exciting time. And like you say, it's not the only drug in your portfolio. So people will be getting likely news on other drugs there as well in your stable there. Tim, thanks very much for coming on. And like you said, there'll be more updates very soon. So I look forward to speaking to you again in the not too distant future.
Thank you, Justin. It's a pleasure to speak to you again.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is CEO of Audioboom. It's Rob Proctor. Rob, thanks for joining me.
Hi, Justin. How you doing?
I'm good, thanks. And for people not aware, the ticker for Audioboom is Boom. It's a good ticker there. So, Rob, for people not aware of Audioboom, I'm sure they've heard of you, though, but what do you actually do as a business?
We're a primarily a B2B platform, so audio creators, podcasters can create, upload, edit, store, and then syndicate and broadcast their digital audio around the web, share it to iTunes and Facebook and Twitter and on their own websites. And then we've obviously got our own websites and apps as well that we distribute through.
Okay. Oh, so yesterday's release was the acquisition of NLP and AI development company Sonar, and also the issue of a £1 million convertible loan note. So Sonar, first and foremost, why are you acquiring it? How will it help the business? What's it all about?
Yeah, so I mean, we've known and we've looked at and we've had conversations, I think, about just over the last year or two that, you know, currently Audioboom uses third-party ad server integrated into our systems to deliver the pre- and the post-roll advertising and inserted advertising across all of our audio, you know, be that in iTunes or, you know, on our partners' websites and whatnot. So there's obviously a cost for using that and an ad server, and there's, you know, on a per thousand cost for doing that. So we know we need to build an ad server. You know, our potential cost in 18 could be, you know, £1.5 million, something like that, for ad serving with a third party. So we've always known we needed to build it. Also, it's our own IP and it's our own reliability. So as part of that process, you know, we've looked at all ad servers. We've used a number of them as well. And the obvious thing that's missing right now on all ad serving is kind of intelligence. So all ad servers work on historic data. You know, you as a user, you know, where did you go? What sites did you look at? What products did you buy? And then it saves that data and then it serves you ad based on that data. So I, for instance, you know, went on the holiday to Corfu last summer. I'm still getting adverts now about Corfu because it's working off historical data. None of the ad servers work off of what content are you looking at right now? What are you most interested in right this second? So in building an ad server that answers that question, especially in audio, you have to know what that content is. And in audio, the only way you can do that is to crack open the file, transcribe it from audio to text. So basically the audio becomes data. And then you need to know the sentiment, the context of that data. Using NLP, natural language processing, and AI, you can actually work out, the computer can work out what that content really means. Once we know what that is, we get that data and we associate it with the audio file. So whenever anybody listens to that audio anywhere around the web, it has these attributes. And those attributes then allow the ad server, the data management platform in the ad server, to serve the most targeted advert. Now that's a major leap forward for the ad industry, and it's, you know, it's like next generation for audio ad servers right now. Audio ad servers today just say play spot ads like you get on the radio. There's no intelligence to them. We're building a system that has true intelligence. The other benefit of all of that, because we know what's in all of the different podcasts, the real sentiment of them, means we can generate and create a next generation recommendation engine. And YouTube, like the vast amount of traffic on YouTube is generated from second and third and fourth clicks. So people, you might like this video and that video. We can't do that in audio right now. The NLP and the AI will allow us to create that. And we can then even recommend the next thing to listen to, even into Twitter and to Facebook. So its ability to drive our traffic is going to be vast.
Yeah, in fact, I saw somebody yesterday, so I'm listening to a lot of podcasts at the moment. Can anyone recommend any? And I suppose that would come in handy. So in summary, essentially, it'll cost you less, you know, in the long term to have your own ad server, and the ads you can deliver from that will be more targeted, so you can charge a bit of a premium. Is that right?
Yeah, well, I mean, definitely, the more data we can supply to some of our partners like WPP or Havas or Publicis, the higher the CPM that commands, so the more we can charge for that advertising, no doubt. The other interesting thing that opens up as well is the better we can target advertising, it then allows us to do some of the very lucrative bounty-based deals. So, for instance, somebody might sign up for, I don't know, X or Y credit card from an advert that we've put in there. Now, if we've really targeted that well, the amount of sign-ups per thousand will increase. But, you know, typically a credit card per sign-up to us at the moment could be worth, you know, anything up to £100-£200 every sign-up. So if we can improve that engagement rate, that sign-up rate through better targeting, then clearly the margins are much better for us downstream.
Yeah, and it sort of makes sense because podcasting is about very targeted listening rather than broadcasting on radio. You know, like I said, and I don't mind. I mean, if I hear an advert that's relevant, it doesn't bother me. So when I constantly have adverts that are not relevant to me, that's what bothers me, you know? So it's definitely a step forward. So
it is. Well, what's interesting, that type of advertising, that in-read advertising from, you know, the podcaster is being sponsored by, the engagement rates for that are massive. So, you know, 70% of everybody in a recent survey, 70% of people that answered the survey said that actually they found in-read podcast advertising actually relevant and helpful to them. Mm-hmm. You contrast that against, you know, 40% of the world's web traffic is now using an ad blocker.
Yeah.
So it's like night and day. Now, what we're attempting to do, yeah, we do the in-red. We're attempting to get that same kind of engagement and, you know, natural affinity between the podcast and the advertiser, but on ad-delivered, programmatically delivered advertising as well. So we're looking to raise that bar across the board.
Yeah, so if this goes ahead, this Sonar acquisition, when do you hope to have your own ad servers and this integrated on those servers?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So the obviously the Sonar acquisition going through, so that's all done. The guys are obviously on the Sonar platform. They have a ton of AI and algorithms on the NLP already developed. Obviously, for our purposes, the thinking is the same, but the education is different. You have to educate an algorithm to look for specific things you want. So We're currently scoping out what that education process looks like and how quickly we can do it. And in conjunction with that, we're building our own platform to do the audio to text transcription. So the guys literally are setting up the architecture for that now. And then there's an education process there. So to make it as accurate as possible, that'll be going on over the next few months. And then in conjunction with that, there's the building of the nuts and bolts of the ad server. You know, what does the analytics dashboard need to do? How does that work? So again, in-house, the team here are meeting with the people at Mindshare and Zenith Opta Media and Havas and Publicis and WPP, really, really defining what does the end user need? And the end user for an ad server is the media agency. So it's, guys, what do you want out of this? What data do you want? What tracking do you want? What targeting do you want? What analytics do you want? So that scoping exercise is happening as well. So it's actually, there are four elements that are all coming together in this one product. So in terms of when do we expect this to roll out? I mean, we're doing, you know, it's by segment. So as we develop the data management platform, it's like the brain of this thing. Mm-hmm. That's our first development. We can actually use that as a module attached to our current third-party ad server. So while we're building the other bit, we could already improve targeting.
Okay.
When would I hope to have a fully finished, market-ready, shiny, beautiful product that actually will be good enough that we can sell to other publishers? So I could go into a Cumulus or an iHeart or somebody else and maybe sell this just as a new platform that they'll just use as an ad server. The line in the sand that we've put is, you know, probably the back end of this year into our Q1, which would be, you know, January, February time next year. So it's probably a year's worth of build for a big, massive, massive platform. But actually, modules of this we're going to be using probably within a few months to improve our own engagement rates and our own return on investment.
Yeah, okay. And let's get on to the second part of the RNS there, which is Nick Candy Ventures, or Candy Ventures there. Subscribed to a convertible loan note up to £1 million. What's this used for? And just take us through some of the terms, if you could, Rob.
Yeah, for sure. So obviously, what I've just described there on, you know, the ad server development, you know, that there is a lot of work in there. And, you know, I think I know a lot of people have know that the shareholders in the company, you know, we focus a lot of our energies out of the UK office to our New York office. The ad server is going to require, you know, a lot of the resource we have here in the UK. Virtually all of it's going to be built here in the UK. So we're putting a good bit of the resource into that. We're obviously bringing on more content all the time. So Undisclosed, one of the podcasts we brought on, that's now up to 500,000 listens an episode. So we're certainly going to be doing a lot more of that, because off the side of that, we can then create more of our own podcasts, mm-hmm. and get people like Undisclosed to promote our other podcasts. We build that volume there. So it's going to be used for a combination of things, but certainly for this next 12-month period, our three big focuses, US, this technical development, to create more money, but also to reduce costs, and acquiring more audience through the content, the big podcasts we bring on, and allowing us to create more podcasts that will hang off the side of that.
Yeah, yeah. I saw someone, I mean, when it comes to convertible loan notes, you know, companies on AIM or investors almost run scared sometimes. But I was talking to somebody else yesterday saying these can take many different structures. And, you know, when it's a separate company altogether, issuing or taking up a subscribing to a loan note, there can be issues. But you've got Nick Candy here, who's of course a cornerstone investor of the company. So he's only there to help the company, isn't he? Really, you know.
It's in everybody's interest. I mean, certainly in the company's interest. I think all of our shareholders' interest, that Candy Ventures is very engaged with Audioboom. Yeah. They clearly back and are continuing to wholeheartedly back the management team, our strategy, and obviously now our revenue growth to go with that, and our aspirations as we look to the US market. I think with Brexit, there are opportunities in strong currencies outside of the UK, you know, France and Germany and whatnot. So having a backer of Candy Ventures, both size and scope, but also the vision of where they invest and where they see the future of digital in things like AI and NLP and, you know, visual object recognition and things like that. You know, for them to be backing us so strongly moving forward, hopefully should be telling everybody, you know, these guys back winners, these guys back digital trends that they believe are going to absolutely come to the fore next year, the year after, and the year after that. And, you know, we can certainly see where we're going right now, that, you know, we're fitting into that kind of mold of companies they invest into.
Yeah, and at the end of part one of this RNS, you did say that you're still targeting cash flow positive in Q1 of 2018, and I think the previous trading update said you're going to exceed 1.3, was it, for the full year last year? And I think is a target of 5.4 for 2017. Is that still out there?
That's absolutely what's out in the market, and you know, I'm sitting here in our studio. Probably the first time in months I've actually sat with my feet up in another chair. I think we are exceedingly happy with those numbers that are out in the market. I'm rather like the 1.1 to the 1.3 in reality that we had out in the market. We're very happy that there's 5.4 out in the market right now.
Okay, read into that what you will, people. So, and also, how is you know, cash burn? We talked about last time. You said it's coming down. Is that still the case?
It is. You know, we're working on that all the time, and obviously building these ad servers is, you know, it's not, you know, I can lose 3 headcount, I'm going to save money next month. This is more strategic. This is about saving us, you know, literally millions of pounds next year and the year after and the year after that. But the work we're doing with our current ad servers in reducing costs, the way we're repositioning our headcount, we're controlling what we need to control, but reflecting the fact that we're in a market that's growing massively, and we need to make sure that we have the capability to keep achieving the land grab that we need, especially in the US, where obviously there's more competition, but actually very importantly here in the UK, where we absolutely want to close out this market over the next 12 months.
Yeah, okay, Rob. Well, listen, if anyone's not following you on Vox Markets, could you give us 3 reasons why they should hit that follow button, please, Rob?
Well, I mean, you know, Q3 to Q4 and our H2 to H1 last year shows where this company's going in terms of revenues. As I've just said, we're very happy with the 5.4 that's out in the market right now. You know, we have some amazing new content partners joining the platform. There'll be more about that over the coming months as we get them embedded. We don't do those kind of announcements too often anymore, given market feedback, but we're super buoyant here. And the pickup and reception that we're now getting at media agencies on both sides of the Atlantic is something, you know, I've certainly talked about, you know, 2.5 years ago, we are getting the kind of responses and the shift in spend from traditional radio into on-demand and podcasting that I was predicting 2.5-3 years ago. That stuff's coming to fruition now. There's a ton of work for us to do, a ton of technology to do. But if we do that and we do it right, they're going to be industry-leading steps forward for the company. So, like I say, I think we're in great shape on all sides, but we don't underestimate absolutely the amount of work that we have to do.
Marvellous. Rob, thanks for chatting to me, and I look forward to chatting to you again off the back of a future update. Thanks very much.
That's great. Thank you indeed, Justin. Brilliant.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is small cap commentator, aficionado, writer, blogger, podcaster, Doc Holliday. You're right, Doc.
All round champion of junior stocks. Yes, sir, I am.
Yeah, talking about that, I see you up late this morning. Didn't catch some of the RNSs out partying late last night, weren't you?
Not quite out partying, but I had the great pleasure of watching Southampton scalp Liverpool yesterday as they go to Wembley. So I shall hopefully get a ticket and go and support my new favourite team, Southampton, versus whoever they meet down at Wembley in the finals. So well done to those guys. So we had a few beers. I've been exercising dry January for about 24 days, whatever it was, and it broke yesterday. So it was a few pints and off to the match.
Yeah, of course. Well, listen, you know, Southampton is down the road from me there, and of course you're in Liverpool there, so I don't know if there's any...
quite clearly, I'm not a Liverpool fan, as you can tell.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so talking about stocks, I know very little about football. I know a tiny bit more about stocks. So looking at the stocks this week, what's caught your eye? What's the hot stocks? What are people talking about on the radar there? What do you reckon? What are you flagging up there?
We know what people are talking about. They're talking about UIU Metals. It's a company that's been heavily, you know, sort of speculated on. The business have raised cash at 40 and 45. The Mr. The Zorbas effect, as it's being quoted, Mr. John Zorbas was sort of instrumental in some of the attention that Mercom Capital experienced in 2016. The shares in that company went from 2p all the way to 48p. One of the actually interesting things here is with Mercom is their share price went to 48p and the stock was raised at 2.5 and they had options at 5p and it didn't seem to stop that train sort of moving down the platform. So UIU Metals, they've got the 12th biggest nickel mine. They have some other assets that are on their books. I think they have an oil asset that often doesn't get mentioned, believe it or not, and a few other bits and pieces, legacy assets that they've been sitting on. It seems that Zorbas now is looking to shape URU Metals into a sort of stronger company. There's been lots of sort of speculation on a number of stocks actually recently. Everybody seems to be mentioning the LI word, you know, lithium. Whether that, you know, comes to amount to anything remains to be seen. But there's a huge amount of interest based on Zorbas, what he's going to do with this company. It is only, I think, a £7-8 million, £9 million market cap. So there's room for movement. I think fundamentally it'd be nice if we saw something to underpin the recent sort of move and activity. But that volume is consistent with there's better things to come. So it's all about trading activity. Consistent volumes, liquidity is absolutely spot on. Almost reminds me of companies like Rare Earth Minerals in 2014, 2015, these types of companies where they're starting to see a bit of life born into them, but that volume is just consistently heavy. And with that, it's huge amounts of liquidity, and that always draws in traders as well as investors.
Yeah, do you know, I'm always fascinated by what catches people's attention on these small stocks, because there are plenty of decent stocks out there, you know, that you could invest in. But sooner or later, one or two of them do catch the attention and imagination of investors. And I suppose if you put together here what it is with URU, it's that a massive asset and the fact that John Zorbas, you know, success in MCC there, together, put that together, and then you've got a little story there. It's very much on AIM, isn't it? It's the stories that catch on are the stocks that do well. Yes, there's an underlying fundamental position there or worth looking at, but they've got to have a little story that works. And if that catches people's investors' imagination, it flies, doesn't it, you know?
The irony is the story hasn't actually changed other than the fact that John Zorbas's level of success has gone up, you know, dramatically of late. You know, momentum's 8/10 of the law. They've got it.
Yeah, it's a lot of talking about sort of, you know, things catching on. I missed out on it. I bought URU about 0.65, so I was right in the right sort of price after the first move, and then I put a stop loss in and tripped myself out and before the massive rise, so I missed out on it. I don't know why that. I very rarely put stop losses in, but you know what?
Why you did it, because you on the weekend podcast you talked to Steve Pete. Yeah. So you know, the irony of this is that the those two. I think, is it Peter? He seems to, you know, seems to know where he's going with this. Steve almost sounds like he's been sitting and listening to Bob Marley with his dreadlocks and smoking the herb. Because, yeah. I mean, I love listening to it, by the way, and anybody who's not listened to the Weekend Podcast should. I love those guys, but just don't listen to him.
I don't know why I took advice from a person who's less experienced than me. I don't know, but it stuck in my head. But so I missed the move there. But I'll never buy now. What I've learned is never buy a spike, you know, unless it really comes back and I relook at it. And another thing, talk about interest in stocks sort of, you know, slowly bubbling under. I've noticed that ECR, and you've mentioned ECR previously, is getting a bit of traction, a bit of attention. It had a bit of a move. Where is it now? It's coming out. So what do you know about ECR? Tell us about ECR, because I know there's interest here, and it hasn't made a massive move yet. It's started to gain a bit of traction, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I mean, it's early days. The company raised some cash in September last year, or October, at 1p. The shares were trading at a pretty decent discount to that in the market. So, you know, for the avoidance of doubt, there he is, Steve or Pete on the phone.
Yeah, exactly.
For the avoidance of doubt, I didn't take part in that placement. I bought some shares in the market and I stated that quite openly. Continued to buy some shares as the interest started to sort of surface on it. And the rationale here is the previous management team were the toxic problem. They've now gone. Mr. Clayson left with a handsome payment, which again, I think sits as a fishbone in people's throats. He then proceeded to drip feed his stock into the market, which just helped erode the price from the fundraising price lower again. Just almost seems that any association with Clayson has been negative for ECR. He's now announced that he's finished selling. That consistent selling subsided, and as a result, there's been some upside. But I actually think that it was the new CEO Brown's interview with UK Investor magazine that actually caught my attention, because he'd stated quite openly that they'd got news in quarter one that they had, you know, near-term funding. He was quite open about the fact that the company had been looking at new assets, and naturally they expected that, you know, to acquire new assets, to develop assets, all of these companies in the early stages would need to raise additional finance, but that wasn't something that was needed at this point in time. He was matter of fact about it. One person you don't say that to is Tom Winifred. You don't tell him that you don't need cash and then go and raise in the market the following week or month, because you've just made yourself an enemy for life. So I've got a funny feeling that he was very open and honest in that interview. It obviously shone a light on that business in my mind, because it was news on its way. We don't need cash at the moment. We don't have a seller anymore. That in itself allows it to become buoyant. What happens from here will be down to the company. They're presenting in the Midlands on Saturday evening. I don't think they've come all the way up from London to go and talk to investors to tell them that nothing's happening and we're doing nothing. In actual fact, we've just been sitting around on our hands. So I actually think that the company are making progress. They're wanting to come and try and convey that message to investors. And there's been a great deal of interest from the Birmingham Rat Pack, which is why they're coming up here. One of the speculative remarks I would make right now is a group of high net worth investors were down in the city meeting ECR within the last week. That's what I've been hearing. Is it any surprise that the price action started to make that move? Absolutely not. It would be, again, consistent with bits of speculation and what we know.
Yeah. One of the stock that, in fact, URU Metals was submitted about a couple weeks back for your watch list on the podcast. And also another stock that's recently submitted that done well, but has pulled back recently, is Hydrodeck, HYR. Do you know anything about them? I mean, I've looked into them. They have said they're going to be sort of EBITDA positive, I think, towards the end of the second half of the year, I think. But they have come back a bit. Do you know anything about HYR?
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't have a massive insight into the business. It was being punted a little bit around last week. There was a little bit of city talk of, you know, what do you know about this company? A lot of people are in my ear now telling me it's time to take positions. Sorry. Huge amount of support come out in the public, huge amount of support in the market buying this stock up. There's clearly a seller. It's a big seller. It's somebody who's selling stock without any great sort of concern for price movement. It almost doesn't seem to be particularly well managed. They're just unloading stock in the market into any big liquidity and pinning the price. You know, it moved from sort of 190 to 2.25 and then it's sort of back at 2-2-10, I think, at my last look. And, you know, for whatever reason, I think Hydrodeck have got a fair bit of stock that's got to come into the market before it can make its move. The fact that from that news of it being EBITDA positive, it's actually quite assuring that once this seller subsides, you're probably going to see a similar type reaction as we've seen with some of these other companies, where you'll get that uplift. But it's knowing where it'll happen from. Having, you know, thrown my neck on the block once before with a company like this, ADSS, which was an absolute car crash, and I got absolutely wrong, I'm less inclined to want to do it now. For me, I would rather be a buyer of this stock into that move than to be buying it, speculating on the move.
Yeah, I think a difference we can say between ADSS and this, I was looking at their trading update, and they do say that they're EBITDA positive in October, and going forward, they say that the second half of the year will be. So we can see, you know, decent. And from memory, I was looking back at their last update, and I think they had $500,000, I think, in cash there. So, you know, they've got some half-decent fundamentals. They are EBITDA positive. Then you suggest maybe they don't need to go to the market. So it's just waiting for that seller to clear, I suppose, isn't it, you know?
And look, just to reiterate, I'm not for 1 minute suggesting that these two companies have got many synergies, other than the fact when I look at companies where there's an active seller and that seller is pinning a price, it almost suggests that they're not looking for additional upside to unload into. They're just happy to keep on chopping it out. That puts me off, and the only thing that resonates with that in my mind was that one particular company mentioned. I don't think there's any synergies between the two businesses, and I'm hopeful that once Hydrodeck watches that selling sort of subside, you'll see some additional upside.
Yeah, okay. Marvellous, Doc. Thanks very much, fella. I'll speak soon.
Cheers, buddy.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is CEO of Brand Communications, Alan Green. You're all right, Al?
I'm good, Jess. How are you?
Good, thanks. And while we're talking, just had breaking news there in Angus Energy. They've released what seems to be a very positive update. And I know I held a bit of stock there. I've sold down a lot of stock because in the back of my head, I had Prospect Oil and Gas, Canadian Overseas Petroleum, both had dusters this year. I still hold a little holding in Angus Energy. But you know, the update is, as we know, basically they've got two little production wells. They've got a production license there down in Brockham there. But they're also drilling the Kimmeridge Limestone, which is part of the Horse Hill area, which Horse Hill did very well with UK Oil and Gas a while back. And they had a small period of flow tests, which they had about 1,600 barrels a day coming. Yeah, 1,600. Now, Angus Energy are drilling that area. They've got a production license. UK Oil and Gas haven't. And they've drilled it. And they're saying they have encountered hydrocarbons that have been missed by BP, because BP previously drilled there, but they didn't look for these. So it looks like they have got this data, and they're doing some more sort of tests on it. So it looks good.
Well, just you and I were talking, and the share price was at about 11p, and it's jumped about 20%. It pushed to that year high again of 14.5p, and you know, there's a flurry of buys and sells, and I tried to sort of top up and couldn't get any more. All over the place.
I had the Vox Markets ping me the RNS there, which is very good. I logged straight on. Trouble is with Barclays stockbrokers, I have to log in twice. I don't know why. First time I log in with correct details, it throws me back to the login page. I do it again. I tried to buy something and I just couldn't buy any stock. You can't get any. Yeah. It's up like 28% now. I've got to say, Jonathan Tidswell, let me just say what he's saying here. He said, we are pleased to have encountered hydrocarbon shows missed in the previous drilling by BP in 1987 in the three Kimmeridge target intervals, and are delighted to see encouragement for the predicted analogy to the Horse Hill geology. Encouragingly, we've also seen oil and gas shows in the underlying Corallian. Further analysis underway, identifying the extent of the hydrocarbon. But initially, a new ultra-wave well logging technology has been used in logging of this well. And once that analysed, allow us to make an image of the borehole. So listen, this looks very good for Angus Energy on first test. And of course, these guys came on the podcast before the IPO, and I've talked about them highly. I did a blog on them. I hold stock in them. But I would like to have held more at this point. I did sell down and, you know, reduce my risk.
Well, I think, there's an old saying in the markets, no one ever went broke taking a profit. And I think that's very true here. You know, Angus is a great little company, but as happens on the way up with these these blue sky companies, the mine the the drilling is developing, the hydrocarbons are there, that's great. There's going to be a flurry of activity, share pushes higher, there'll be some retracement as people wait for the next batch of news to come out. And you know, it's the chart looks like a relief map of the Himalayas, you know, but going toward the top right hand corner. So they're going to be buyers and sellers on the way up, then all those sellers come out, a new wave of buyers come in at the high price. So that's obviously the nature of the beast. But en route, you've taken some profit, Just, and that's what it's about.
Yeah, exactly. You shouldn't be sad about having a bit of a profit there.
Indeed.
So let's move on to some other stocks you're looking at. Al, what are you looking at the moment?
Okay, we talked about feedback before, FDBK. Now, yep. Last week there was widespread press coverage on issues with prostate cancer, and the time that when a guy goes in and has they're analysing his situation, a biopsy is usually undertaken. That takes time to come back and so on. Now, it was proven through a test at University College of London, through trials at University College of London by Dr. Hashim Ahmed, that MRI scans, in a sample undertaken, over a quarter of men that had suspected prostate cancer could have avoided a biopsy if they'd had an MRI scan first. That is to say, the MRI scan picks up the condition. Now, also in that test, Feedback's jewel in the crown product, TexRad, which is a medical imaging software, and it picks up conditions by scanning X-rays and images of conditions, and it picks up tumors and potential lesions earlier than the naked eye or traditional methodology will do. And TexRad was used in these tests, and what it did, it speeded up the process to the point where instead of having to go through hundreds and thousands of images, the TexRad software did that for them and identified the conditions. So there is a clear possibility here that treatment for prostate cancer in the UK could be changed completely using MRI scans and TexRad. And it was covered both by the BBC, by The Guardian, Telegraph, and a number of other publications last week. And on the back of that feedback, put an announcement out of trying to stimulate a great deal of reaction and response. But I know some of the journalists who've written those articles are now looking into this. So it's exciting for TexRad and for feedback. You know, the company is still a tiny little £5 million company. TexRad is being used all over the world. Its applications vary greatly. It's used for colorectal scans, breast, lung, prostate. Obviously, we've discussed esophageal, head, neck, and renal cancers. So it's got this massive range of applications, and the company is really starting to progress this. And clearly, with this sort of publicity, one would expect that the prospects for feedback in the next few years should be very bright indeed.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. And I've seen they've risen on the release of that news, haven't they?
They have, yeah. It's progressed slightly, but not on a great deal of volume. But I would expect that as the journalists maybe look into this in more detail, that we're going to see some more progress in the run up to the interim results next month.
Okay, marvellous. Anything else you're looking at, Al?
Yeah, a couple of others. Obviously, advanced oncotherapy we discussed before, and and I know there was an announcement at the start of the week the Sanofi agreement had been terminated, and there was a big sell-off in the stock, and the stock dropped, I think, from 70p to 50p or 50-60p, which is where it's trading now. Now, the thing is with this, the Sanofi agreements, it was flagged before Christmas that there was an issue with the Sanofi agreements. So effectively, the market, we thought, had priced that in, but there was still a massive sell-off. a couple of things have happened since then. Firstly, there was a huge amount of director share buying over the Christmas period. Now, we're not talking sort of 5, 10, 15,000. We're talking sort of hundreds of thousands of pounds, directors picking up shares between 50, 70 and as high as 85p. That's number one. Number two, the company has today announced that two new non-executive directors have been appointed. Now, these directors, Professor Steve Myers, who's been involved in Adam and developing the business, and in fact, Professor Steve Myers will be providing a presentation at a Proactive one-to-one evening this evening up in London. So if anyone hasn't already got tickets, if you want to find out more about advanced oncotherapy, haven't already got tickets, then apply quickly, although the event, as they often are, may well be sold out. The other gentleman is a guy called Mr. Hans von Selsing, who is a medical expert, and he has many years of experience in radiation therapies. And again, this is a situation where, yeah, advanced oncotherapy has hit some problems clearly with Sinofi, but these two guys are highly respected in their fields. They're not going to join the board and raise their profile on the back of advanced oncotherapy if they don't absolutely believe in the product and what's happening. And of course, the evaluation of advanced oncotherapy currently is about the value of one of their light machines. So there seems to be very little upside prospect price into that. And if anyone was looking to top up AVO, now might be a very good time.
Yeah, well, they dipped to like 46 pence, and it'd be interesting to see that they're 59 today. It'd be interesting to see if they test that level again. Because, at the moment, the product seems to be amazing that they have, but we need deals here, don't we? You know, we need to sell some of these these machines, to get it going. And in the meantime, I understand they're signing, eminent people in the field of where they exist, in this proton beam therapy. But again, they come at an expense, don't they? So you've got to get the deals out there. And if this product is amazing, then they have to get some deals done, I think. But on a technical level, it's worth keeping an eye on because, like I said, it may not retest that 46. It may go higher from here. So it's worth and of course, when investing, there's two different sides. There's a technical bounce that can happen.
Yeah.
And of course, there's the fundamental side of it. And so you've got to sort of try and put this together and come up with a strategy in your head there. But going back when you first mentioned this company to me, I thought it's an amazing product, almost too good to be true here. But yet they've had a lot of stumbling blocks, a lot of problems the last year, and that's reflected in the share price. So it is now an opportunity. Do your own research, everyone. This is not investment advice. It's just information. And
exactly, yeah.
Making a decision there. Okay. Anything else, Al?
Yeah. Been looking at a number of sort of below the radar companies over the past few months. And found another one. And again, this was through using the Vectorverse software earlier this week. It flagged up the metrics, or the metrics were flagged up for a company called Swallowfield. The epicode is SWL. Now, this is a company that provides aerosol packaging and tubes, roll-ons, and so on for personal care products. One of its products, the Royal Shaving Company brand, its shaving gel, won an award at the GQ Grooming Awards. So that was last year, and the shares had a bit of a run off the back of that. But again, this company is a bit behind the scenes. It supplies a lot of products to other payments, and the prospects for the company have developed and pushed forward and grown nicely. November last year, the AGM statement said the company was trading in line with expectations, had a number of new product launches for major brand owners that are lined up, and expects that to contribute to group performance in the first half of the year. Contract wins across the UK and Europe. profitability for the first half, and we're in the run-up to those results late February, early March. Profitability in the first half, we'll see a small benefit from the sterling weakness. So this is a company that sells all over the world, so if the pound falls, it benefits. So there are some expectations there too. And again, the valuation on the VectorVest system shows that the company's currently worth about 440p per share, and the shares are currently trading at about 290p. So there is real potential here. The from a technical standpoint, the chart looks very, very bullish too. Again, the company is trading at an all-time high again, so it's very difficult to make a trading call on this. So anyone wanting to buy the stock might want to wait for a retracement. But in the run-up to, if we're about 4 to 6 weeks before a major announcement, then there will be a lot of trading activity within that week. So it might be an idea anyone considering buying the stock might want to look at any dips in the run-up to that announcement. And often in the markets, as we know, there's an old saying, it's better to travel than it is to arrive. So clearly, if there's any disappointment in the announcements with the way the price action has been developing, there could be a retracement after that. So again, investors might want to wait until after the results. But nonetheless, one to put on your watch list, a great company, big cash generator, currently worth about $49 million with a great deal of potential upside. That's Swallowfield SWL.
Marvellous, Al. Thanks for the information. Speak to you next week, fella.
Thank you, Jess. All the best.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. By the way, I am looking for a stock to put in my feature, one for your watch list. If you know one, please submit it, because there's an empty gap here now and it could be featuring on tomorrow's podcast. And if you know of a stock, like you said, that should be on other people's watch lists, then please submit it. It will give it the air of publicity, which sometimes is all it needs. A good stock with good fundamentals that has the potential to have a re-rate in its price, then it needs, obviously, investors to take notice of it and do some research on it. And so if you want to give it a bit of publicity, please go to voxmarkets.co.uk/blog and submit. Oh, there's one, an RNS there. By the way, get the app and from Vox, and you get RNSs like that straight to the front screen of your smartphone. But like I said, go to voxmarkets.co.uk/blog and click one of my posts there, scroll down, and you'll see a link there just below the big five number on the blog post. All right, top five most followed companies. At five, Ashley House, ASH, the first time it's ever been featured. At four, Michael Trabbia, was on yesterday from Boss Global Holdings, BOS. At three, also on the podcast this week, was Andrea Catania, Zenith Holdings, or Zenith Energy, Z-E-N. At two, URU Metals, URU. We talked about that with Doc, a very highly followed stock. And at number one, biggest riser on AIM yesterday, hopefully Colin will be on the podcast very soon, the CEO of Ascent Resources, most followed company on Vox Markets. And I think it's now pretty much the number third most followed stock ever on Vox Markets. That's AST. All right, top five most liked RNSs on the Vox Markets platform this morning were, at five, New Oil and Gas, Newog. That's CPL, signs up to secure projects. At four, Pantheon Resources, PANR, a drilling update. At three, it's EVR Holdings, EVR issue of equity. Someone there, options. Thing they exercising the options, which are 1.4p, which is quite nice considering the price is over 9p now. At two, Premier African Minerals, PREM, Zulu Lithium and Tantalum Project Update. And number one, the most liked RNS, which I just talked about with Alan there, was Angus Energy, ANGS, a Brockenfield update. Looks quite positive there. They've seen hydrocarbon flows, or they're doing more tests. But as yet, that drain looks like it's on the right track. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Don't forget, everything you hear is not investment advice, just information. And like I said, it's a stepping stone for further research. But in the meantime, thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.